You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
What a beautiful day for horses in the morning.
You are listening to the number one horse podcast in the world. Here's your entertaining look at the horse world and the people in it.
I'm Julie Broadway, president of the American Horse Council.
And I'm Emily Stearns, Health, Welfare, and Regulatory Affairs Liaison for the American Horse Council.
And you're listening to the special monthly American Horse Council episode of Horses in the Morning on the Horse Radio Network for August of 2026.
It's time to hear from the American Horse Council in this monthly episode of Horses in the Morning.
So, Emily, agritourism is one of the fastest growing segments of the rural travel, and it's creating new opportunities for farms, ranches, and horse businesses across the country. While many of us have experienced agritourism as visitors, we haven't really talked a whole lot about from the perspective of people who are creating those experiences.
And we've talked about travel a lot for horse shows and trail rides and vacations. But today, you know, we talked about we want to kind of flip the script. We're talking about how opening your farm or your horse business to visitors can become part of your business plans. And for folks that don't own a business, this is a really great opportunity to learn about fun things that are out there to do on farms.
And when people hear the term agritourism, they often think it just means like a trail ride or a dude ranch. But it's actually so much broader and deeper than that.
I think, Julie, you talked about it a little bit, too, even in just your trip to White Stallion out west, that agritourism, it can include everything from farm tours and educational programs to seasonal festivals, fancy hosted dinners, clinics, camps, weddings, yada, 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 overnight stays. So, like, just simply inviting people to experience agriculture on your property, and horses can be part of that experience, but they don't have to be the experience.
No, they can be a great attraction, though. I'll just say it. So we actually got to experience a little agritourism ourselves during the American Horse Council's conference this year. One of the highlights of our conference was visiting with the U.S. Army Caisson Platoon at their barn, which is adjacent to Arlington National Cemetery. It wasn't a trail ride. It was not a ranch vacation, but it was an opportunity to kind of go behind the scenes, meet the people caring for those incredible horses, learn about their history and the mission, and experience a working equine operation that most people never get to see. Mostly we were excited just to, of course, pet the horses. But I'm always fascinated to interview the officers and understand what their backgrounds are. Did you have any experience with horses before you got into the Caisson Platoon? Now that you've had this experience, are you going to continue with horses? You know, tell me a little bit. And it's a real mixed bag. Some of those officers are kids who rode rodeo, so they know a little bit about horses. Some of them had never been near a horse in their life. This is their first opportunity. They're learning all new skills and all new ways to interact with livestock. So it was a fascinating field trip, Emily.
I'm always impressed, too, that when you get a bunch of horse people in a room with horses, like you said, how excited they are just to pet the horses. People are excited just to pet horses, whether we're horse people or not horse people. So it's a great example of people looking for authentic experiences, really. So non-riding things I've done on horse farms when I travel are things like getting ice cream from a food truck in the parking lot. When I went to Iceland, we got to groom the Icelandic ponies. I did ride one, but also we were just really excited to pet them. And going and watch the horses at Breeze at Keeneland, you know, that counts as agritourism. So those experiences really stick with you and kind of connect you to wherever you are.
So funny side note real quick, Emily. A couple of years ago, I spoke at the Kentucky Equine Law Conference, and I had to get an Uber from the hotel to get over to Keeneland to the sales facility, which is where they hold the conference at. And the Uber driver got lost, and we ended up having to go through the back stretch and around all the barns in order to drop me off that morning to speak at the conference. And I was just like, stop the car. Let me just get out because I'm behind the track. I'm seeing everything that's going on with the back stretch workers and everything that's happening there. And it was just so fascinating to me. And I was just like, went down a rabbit hole. Anyway, sorry, I digress. So one of the things that listeners should know is that according to the U.S. Agritourism Directory, there are more than 13,500 agritourism businesses across the U.S. They range from farms and ranches to vineyards to orchards and countless other agricultural experiences. I just learned about the Cheese Trail, and Maryland this month is having the Ice Cream Trail. So all of these different agribusinesses are creating different ways for people to get really engaged and learn more about, you know, what we do.
And we listened to the guest we have today at our conference, and we're excited to have you all listen to her in our interview portion. But I'm just, after listening to her present, I'm aiming for my farm to be agritourism business number 13,501. So it's a lot to think about as we listen in. So we're broadening the scope, really. We want these ag businesses to include more horse farms and get everyone out there thinking about how they can think beyond traditional boarding or training models and explore whether agritourism, whatever that looks like, could become another way to kind of connect the public and diversify their business.
Hey, and a quick side note and a shout out to my good friend, Dr. Chelsea Hussman at the University of Texas A&M. She grows wildflowers, and she has tours of her flower fields and goes to farmers markets and sells bouquets of flowers. And it had never occurred to me that you could make a whole business model out of just doing that right there. It's like, oh, Okay, so to help us navigate all that, we've got a really great guest today, an expert in agritourism, we believe, because we heard her at conference, and to discuss what opportunities exist and what makes a successful operation and how horse businesses can decide if agritourism is a good fit for them. So stay tuned to learn more, and we'll be right back, but we're going to take a quick break and hear from our sponsors. Okay, so this segment, folks, is brought to you by Jarvis Insurance. For over 80 years, integrity, professionalism, loyalty, and compassion have been the foundation of everything that they do. They are a fourth-generation agency, and their legacy speaks for itself, and so does their commitment to protecting what matters most to you as horse people. Proud corporate sponsors of the American Horse Council, they understand the unique needs of horsemen and horsewomen, because they are horsemen and horsewomen themselves. From tragedy to triumph, they're with you every step of the way. Your dreams deserve protection you can trust. That's why they offer comprehensive equine insurance solutions, including mortality coverage, worldwide protection, farm and ranch policies, and liability coverage tailored to support every aspect of your equine lifestyle. So check out C. Jarvis Insurance Agency, protecting your dreams for four generations and counting.
We are excited to have with us Aubriana Johnson. Aubriana, welcome. Please take a second to introduce yourself.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here. Repeat, not quite a repeat, but after the AHC conference, I'm like, yes, let's talk about agritourism as many times as possible. So my name is Aubriana. I'm from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and my background is actually in veterinary medicine. So if you know anything about attempting to get into vet school, you know that you have to get thousands of hours of experience. I was able to do that throughout college, going to NC State, and I went to so many farms. I got experience with horses because that was my passion, but I got to see small ruminants, camelids, alpacas, llamas, goats, actual camels, cows, and in traveling to a lot of those different farms, I got to see all of the things that farmers all across North Carolina are doing to make money on their farms. And it was there that I discovered, wait a minute, those farmers are not simply farming. That's not the only thing that they're doing, especially when they're, you know, have a flock of sheep and they're doing wool classes and fleecing classes and teaching people the craft of fiber work, right? That was where I discovered agritourism and where I kind of really got interested in it.
So before I get to my question for you, I have to just do two little shout outs. Number one, my husband and I are both originally from North Carolina, so go Pack, woohoo, Wolfpack. And number two, I first got exposed to you because you were doing a reading program with a miniature horse. Take just a minute to help people know a little bit about how great that program is. And I know you're coming to Maryland maybe soon to do that program. So talk about that for just a second.
Yes, that's my precious baby angel sent from above. So in 2019, I actually started writing and illustrating children's books. The series is called Cowgirl Cameron. And I happened upon a little miniature horse from Craigslist who was just simply fantastic with children. And so I said, you know what? I am all about increasing representation in kids' literature and in the horse industry. So how about I write some children's books about this little miniature horse and we can go off and do readings, you know, in schools and libraries and community centers and read and teach kids about horses and Black cowboy culture and what that experience is like. So that is what Cowgirl Cameron is. And Little Encore, the miniature horse, is a character in those children's books. And he gets to go with me to libraries, school events. We go everywhere, all up and down the East Coast. And we are on his second van. Never thought that I would be buying specific cars for my animals, but here we are. And, you know, we just go around and really try to ensure that kids are having a good, positive first experience with horses. So after we read the books, they get to come up and pet Encore and learn about them. And he just is a gem. He's got his little Build-A-Bear Converses that he wears. He's, you know,
I'm a little disappointed we didn't invite Encore onto the podcast with you.
You know,
he probably has strong opinions.
He does. And recently I was just informed by my parents that his newest opinion is whether or not the fence is optional. He was out this morning. So me and Encore need to have a conversation.
So I only do that little bit of introduction, folks, because this is a true entrepreneur. You can see the diversity of all the different things that she's doing to try to bring agriculture to the people and to get people to come to agriculture. So the question that I have is, what's the definition of agritourism? Because I think there's a lot of misperceptions about what agritourism is.
Yeah, absolutely. And the simplest way that I can put it is that agritourism is any activity that invites the public onto a working farm or ranch or some sort of agricultural operation for the purposes of education, entertainment, recreation, or hospitality. So there's a range of things that lives in there, but if they are coming there not solely to purchase the commodity that's being produced, that anything outside of that transaction can be considered agritourism.
And so I think it's important to note maybe in that definition that there has to be a separate commodity, right? So like if you're an education program and your sole thing is education, then that wouldn't necessarily count as agritourism if like the sole program is education.
Correct. Right. So for example, non-horsey example, a strawberry farm. If you're putting on a workshop on the life cycle of strawberries while you're on a strawberry farm, those are two separate things, right? Versus being a nature school who happens to teach the life cycle of a strawberry. That wouldn't necessarily be agritourism if that nature school didn't live on an actual working farm.
Got it. So then I think in like the grand scheme of all this agritourism stuff, giving examples like that are really helpful. But what's kind of a fun fact people maybe don't know about agritourism?
I don't know if the fact is really, I think the fact is fun that I'm about to share, but one of the things that I found just by being in the world of agritourism is that not a lot of horse farms are leveraging agritourism as a revenue stream. And there could be many reasons for that, but I kid you not, when I go into these larger agritourism conferences and have conversations with people, and I say, okay, so how do I apply this, or how have you seen this applied specifically for a horse farm? They're like, what do you mean?
And maybe like, this is like a bigger philosophical discussion then of like, what is it about horse people that
we operate in very, yeah, very narrow ways, don't we?
Yes, we do. And I think the challenge has been not considering ourselves farmers.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a great, and that's something Julie and I really pressure for, right? Because horses are livestock, and thus we are agriculture and we are farms. Mm-hmm. And for some people, there's definitely that disconnect a little bit.
Yeah.
So my follow-up question is going to be a little weird. So I have to preface this by saying, so a lot of people call us at the American Horse Council and say, I've got these empty stalls. I think I'm just going to open a boarding business. This can't be that complicated. And we're like, whoa, hold on. There's a whole lot to consider here. So talk a minute about what people should think about. What are the challenges that they should consider if they want to try to leverage agritourism and bring this experience to people on their property?
Right. So this kind of goes into what we were just talking about. I feel like the first challenge is your mindset, right? And what agritourism is a separate part of the business. It is not going, you can't go from, you know, I'm a horse trainer and I only ride horses and that's all I have to do, to doing agritourism without doing a lot of mental, you know, gymnastics to say, okay, this is a different part of the business. So there are different things I need to consider, like dealing with the public. And that was what a lot of the feedback that I got after the AHC presentation, to say, well, I don't want to deal with the public. And I'm like, okay, well, don't make that a revenue stream. But also, if you want revenue, you got to deal with the people who have the money. So thinking differently about what your business looks like is the first challenge anyway. Immediately after that is understanding what you need to do for safety purposes when you are bringing additional people on the farm. And I like to tell people, agritourism is so vast and you can be so creative. You do not have to think about hordes, tens, hundreds of people coming to your farm for you to do agritourism. Even if you're bringing 5 to 20 to your farm, these are the considerations you're going to have to think about. Insurance. What does your liability insurance look like? What does it cover? How are we managing the welfare of the animals? What experiences are you creating to make sure that they are still happy and healthy on the farm? And how are you going to manage the visitors? A lot of agritourism operations do not allow free reign of the farm. So what are some of the things that you're going to have to do as far as infrastructure to say, hey, you can come here, but you cannot go there? Or this little section is for, you know, the petting zoo. Do not feed that little horse over there, no matter how cute he looks. Sometimes he bites, you know, having a sign for that. And then depending on the scale of the operation, thinking about that infrastructure, what is parking going to look like? What is your bathroom situation? Do you want to have hundreds of people on your farm and you only have porta potties? That adds a little bit of a complexity, because no one wants to go in a porta potty in July. Well, I live in the South, so I'm specifically
I'm in the North. Yeah.
Okay.
Horse people, right? Like, we're really used to porta potties. And actually, just as a funny aside, because like I said, you know, we're thinking about what we can do on our property, and a dear friend of mine who helps manage events, you know, we were talking about it, and we manage horse shows together. I'm like, I'm paying for the bougie toilets. We're getting the trailers because toilets are definitely part of your experience.
Yes. And if you are creating an environment that invites families, that is a deal breaker. Can I get these children to the bathroom while they're there? And that also changes how long people stay on property. And that's one of the metrics that a lot of agritourism operators measure. The longer you can get people to stay on the property, the more money they spend. So if you're doing food and beverage on the property, again, talk to your insurance. But that is one of the ways that you can increase the value of your visitors when they come. Having those bathrooms makes a difference.
So I'm envisioning hearing an episode later this year when Emily gets this thing off the ground to tell us all about the charcuterie and the cheese boards and all the other things that she's doing since she's doing bougie toilets too.
Charcuterie so last year, Julie.
And I just want to say the last thing is, you know, the marketing and promotion. It's completely different than a boarding facility or a training operation or even a breeding facility, right? You're not talking to prospective horse owners. You're talking to the horse interested, you know, the families that are like, yes, I've never been able to be in this close proximity to these horses or to horses at all. Or my kid, everyone, you know, I'm sure we were those little girls who were horse obsessed, but the parents just didn't know how to get their kid around the horses. That is one of the ways. So it's a different market. And yeah, you have to market differently because of it.
Well, you just hit on something and I was trying to find that number right off the top of my head, but like 35 million households in the U.S. contain a horse enthusiast, but only about, what's the statistic, Emily? It's like only about 10% or so of those, maybe not even that many, are horse owners or active participants. So there's this.
So I think like 1% are horse owners, 10% are active participants.
But what that tells us when we do these economic impact studies is there's this huge market out there that's waiting to be seized and wants to be involved. We've just got to create the opportunities for them to get involved. So give us some examples of some agritourism businesses. You had some at conference that everybody in the room just loved.
Yeah. One of my favorite examples is a track that I went to in South Carolina. It is Springdale Training Center. I've gone to the Carolina Cup down there, the steeplechase competition. They do a biscuits and breezing, and you can go out and watch the horses breeze in the mornings, the things that they're going to be doing any day, every day, but bringing people out and giving them biscuits and allowing them to watch. That is such a low lift agritourism activity that has so much value. Not only will those people come back for the big shows like the Carolina Classic or Carolina Cup, I mean, but they can lend perspective in conversations about advocacy for the horse industry in that area. They can offer that support because they've been there. One of my other favorite examples, because I've studied wine for the last 4 years, going out to Napa and riding horses through the vineyard at one of the wineries out there. That is also a thing, you know. Of course, when you get off the horse, you've had such a great time that you need to do a wine tasting and eat some charcuterie. And that's fantastic.
Oh, that's amazing. There is a vineyard in Virginia, and I don't recall the name of it, but they have created an entire entertainment venue. So you don't go to necessarily drink the wine. You go to hear the band and to enjoy the outdoors and have a fire pit and all that kind of thing. And then you're having such a good time with your friends. Of course, you do drink some wine, and then you buy some bottles of wine to take home. And they've just totally created an experience and they have a food truck guy that comes and pulls up and you can order food. I mean, it's just amazing what they have kind of assembled to make this whole business model work for them.
Yeah. One of the things we're thinking of, and I'm going to tip my hat, but like if any horse farms out there want to take my idea, as long as they're not within 10 miles of my property, we're going to do, I'm going to call them sheep shows, and we're going to do 3 movie nights next summer out in our sheep field. Mm-hmm. And you can get one of those portable movie screens, and people are going to come park with their picnic blankets. And we'll do we're going to try to time it on days we move the sheep from one field to another. So people get to learn about our rotational grazing, and that's going to be it. So like on a horse farm, if you have a nice pasture mm-hmm. or a nice grass field, park those people with a movie screen right next to their horses, and they're going to want to just sit there and look at your beautiful horses and watch, you know, Finding Nemo or something.
Yeah. I also wanted to share, kind of going back to the intro, Julie, when you were talking about your friend and the flowers. I know a lot of agritourism farms who have planted flowers that they'll eventually cut, but because they grow so beautifully, they allow photographers to come out and they're not even the farm operators, not even actively doing anything. The photographers are renting the time or the space to bring their clients out to take photos. So the horses aren't even involved, but they want that environment. They want the ambiance. They want the flowers and the horses in the background. And, you know, not everything has to be actively hands-on with the horse. And I think that is absolutely an opportunity that horse farms can leverage.
There is a farm near us that charges $500 for a private 2-hour Instagram session in their sunflower field. And that's all. They do nothing. You just get 2 hours to yourself in the sunflower field. They don't have to be supervised, and they get $500 for those 2 hours.
Yeah. And it sounds crazy until you realize people are paying it.
Yeah. Okay. So Emily, side note again, you made me think, if you're going to do a sheep thing, I'm definitely coming to visit, because I'm hoping one of the movies is going to be The Sheep Detectives with Hugh Jackman.
Oh, it's a great, I didn't even think of like, I mean, obviously we'll watch like Babe and The Sheep Detectives, you know.
Just saying. Oh my gosh. Are there some really innovative other businesses you want to share that really stand out to you?
Yeah. They don't have to be horse related. Yeah.
Well, I really enjoyed seeing the farm stays, where somebody puts up either maybe a camper or like a little cabin or tiny house on the farm. And that could be booked out for like artist residencies or Airbnb, something like that. I've really enjoyed seeing how people make that a part of their farm. I love anything with a goat or alpaca. Okay. So you see things like goat yoga, and I just saw, scrolling online, ponies and Pilates, and they were doing Pilates right on the outside of a field of miniature horses. Yes, sign me up, okay? There's so many things to do. Escape rooms, corn mazes or different kinds of mazes. I know in the
hay bale mazes is something I've seen. If you don't want to plant corn, I bet you have a lot of hay and hay bales and a hay bale maze for kids, of just like a single, not even stacked, just one hay bale on the ground.
Yeah. Or any sort of, and it doesn't even have to be a routine, like we're open every weekend for this thing, executive retreats. You know, if you have a property that has that aesthetic, beautiful factor, and you have the room for it, say you have an apartment over your barn or some sort of building, you absolutely can do things like that. And yeah.
Cool. So where do people go? Where do they find the resources to learn more about agritourism, and what are the protocols or the processes they need to follow? Because I'm sure if I had the property like Emily does and I wanted to establish this, I can't just go do that and hang out a sign or start running an ad. You got to check with somebody.
Yeah, you definitely need to check with your town or city zoning, right? That is the one of the first steps to make sure you are in compliance with whatever the rules are in your area. Also, checking your state agritourism association. Many states have them, and they have a ton of resources that are specific to your state. And they have the resources that can help you advocate for agritourism if you need to take something to your town zoning to make sure that you're in compliance with what you have going on. Talking to Cooperative Extension. Every state has one of those. Your state's Department of Agriculture, Farm Bureau, because you're going to have to figure out the insurance thing. Talk to your insurance companies. But I have a couple of agritourism-specific resources. They are online newsletters or associations, the Global Agritourism Network. There is an individual called White Hutchinson. You just Google White Hutchinson. The most comprehensive agritourism newsletter I have seen in my life. It is so detailed with research and statistics and current trends and, you know, what are people using to manage tickets or ticketing on their farms? How are they organizing visitor flow? Things like that. And then the last one is the North American Farmers Direct Marketing Association, NAFMA. They have a lot of resources for agritourism as well. And in North Carolina, we have a platform called Visit NC Farms. And that is an app that shows all of the North Carolina farms that have signed up. And you can build out itineraries on there. You can see trails, like you were saying, the cheese trail or the blueberry trail or the wine trail or the women-owned farms trail. Things like that are available on some of these smaller, very niche pieces of technology that are built just for these kinds of experiences.
Okay, folks. So we'll put all that in the show notes so you can go back and find those links. Are there grants or funders available to help startups do this? I think, Emily, didn't you get a grant to do some of your sheeping?
Yeah, so it's not agritourism related, but my grants are through the National Resource Conservation Service in terms of getting fencing for my pasture and redoing the farm road that leads from the main road back to where our pasture is. And I would not be able to be considering doing any of these activities next year if we didn't get that grant for the farm road, because people need to be able to drive to where we're going to have the parking. So there are, if you're creative, there are definitely ways to find some funding out there. It's not necessarily a quick process, especially if they're government-related funds, but there is opportunity out there if you're looking.
Yeah,
you're exactly right. And the government likes to fund things that are already started. They don't, it's not like I have this idea and I would like some money. They like the for people to already have land, already have some skin in the game. And so you're exactly right. Reaching out to the NRCS, and this goes back to our horse farm owners, our farmers. When you think like a farmer, you get into the rooms where the farmers are and you understand the resources that are available to the farmers. Because I went to Small Farms Week in North Carolina A&T University and learned that there are on-farm field trials. And there was a representative there and he was saying, yeah, we are testing fencing and we're looking for places, you know, we don't have the capital to have the animals. So we're looking for places to install fencing so that we can see how it fares. And I'm like, horse person brain alert, you want to fence my, you want to pay me to fence my farm?
Mm-hmm. And what I love, so I learned about the NRCS grants because when we bought this property and I was going to need to be driving more than just a truck and trailer, I did the women's tractor driving and maintenance class through Cooperative Extension at the local land grant university. Mm-hmm. And one, it was a great way to network with other local women farmers. And B, that's where I met the extension agent that manages connecting farmers with NRCS. And that's how I got my grants. So like, think like a farmer. I'm just a horse girl that decided to get some sheep to make 60 acres feel worth it. Mm-hmm. There's opportunity out there if you're getting creative.
Yeah. And then just general business grants, right? Looking at ways to expand or increase the value of a business. There are grants out there that invest in that. So think about where your positionality is. Are you a woman-owned business? Are you a minority-owned business? Are you a small business? Are you a veteran-owned business? Looking at those different intersections to find grants that are specific for you or for a specific part of your business. Like, for example, I got a grant to increase the value of my business through trademarking. Because I wanted trademarks. I trademarked the Cowgirl Cameron book series. So I was able to pay, or they paid for that. I didn't have to pay for any of it, but it wasn't, please fund my entire business. No, it was this very specific part of my business. The grantors, the funder's goal was to increase the value of small businesses. And that was one of the ways. So there's so many ways to do it.
Now you're giving me this really interesting idea I'll pursue offline. But years ago when I lived in Raleigh, there were these small business incubators.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Starting a new business, you could get a little space in the incubator. Mm-hmm. You don't have to have brick and mortar. We could create a farm girl, you know, kind of incubator and do it virtually. There's a lot of ways to go about doing this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, Emily, what else do we need to do? And then we'll wrap up and get with the rest of today's episode.
I fear if we keep going, I'm just going to have Aubriana write a business plan for me over the next hour. So I think we have to cut it here.
Well, we are so appreciative of your presentation at conference. We are so appreciative of your time today. Folks, we'll put a lot of contact information in the show notes. And we may have her back for episode number 2 a little bit down the road to sort of see how some of these other things have kind of matured and evolved over time. And if you have an agribusiness out there in our space, let us know so we can give you a shout out on social media. We're always happy to promote people who are doing unique and innovative things in the entire ag equine community. So thank you again for your time and have a great rest of your week.
Thank you so much for having me.
So our legislative and regulatory update is brought to you today from Piranha. Whether you're on the back of a horse at the barn or watching from the sidelines, there is nothing more annoying than a flying insect. And flying insects are a big deal at this time of the year, folks. So family owned and made in the USA and with over 50 years of experience, you can count on Piranha, your trusted leader in insect control to keep those pests away. Check it out. It works. So, Emily, our legislative and regulatory update today, you mentioned tackling a topic that almost every horse owner will deal with at some point in time, and that is horse movement.
Yes, and I love this topic because it's something people don't often think about until they're getting ready to hook up the trailer, which is too late. And whether you're headed to a horse show, a trail ride, a clinic, a breeding farm, a sale, or moving to a new boarding facility, in-state, out-of-state, what have you, there are rules in place that keep horses healthy while they're traveling.
And I think sometimes those rules can feel like it's just another piece of paperwork, but there's actually a really good reason that they exist.
Yes. And it's something we hammer on with USDA in particular all the time, but the horse industry, especially compared to other livestock industries, is incredibly mobile. So unlike many other livestock species, horses travel constantly. The same horse back and forth, multiple horses back and forth across the country, in and out of towns, one day a week, 10 days a month, you know, all the time. Horses are on the move. Some horses can visit 5 or 6 states in a single competition season, and others are attending fairs or rodeos or trail rides where they come into contact with hundreds or thousands of other horses, especially at some of those big events.
And I know that is one of the things that is so unique about our industry.
Yes, but it also means that if a contagious disease gets into the system, it can spread very, very quickly. And that is why movement regulations exist. They're designed to slow or stop the spread of disease while allowing as much normal movement as possible.
So before we dive too deeply into movement restrictions, let's talk about that paperwork that most horse owners are familiar with.
Right. So the two big ones are a certificate of veterinary inspection, or CVI. A lot of us just call it a health certificate, and your Coggins tests.
Now, people sometimes think those are interchangeable, but they're actually pretty different.
Yep. So a Coggins test is the blood test that tests for equine infectious anemia, or EIA. And once a horse becomes infected with EIA, there's no cure. So testing is one of the primary tools we have to prevent the disease from spreading. And your certificate of veterinary inspection is completed by an accredited veterinarian after examining your horse. And it's a document that says the horse appeared free of signs of any contagious disease at the time of examination. And it has to meet certain requirements for the state you are importing to.
And those requirements may vary greatly.
Yeah. So depending on where you're going, most states require a CVI for horses before entering the state, completed within like a certain number of hours or days before they get on their trip. And many require proof of a current negative Coggins, usually within a year. Some states require 6 months. Some states have additional requirements depending on the disease situation that they have going on actively or the type of movement. So if you're coming from a different country, if you're coming from a specific bordering state, or if you're coming from a state that is multiple states away, they could have different requirements just based on your origin. So that's why it's always important to check before you travel, like many days before you travel, in case you need a CVI, rather than just assuming the requirements are the same for everywhere you're going.
So I know what a lot of people think is, well, who exactly gets to decide what those requirements are?
And that's a great question, because there's just one agency making these decisions, right? So as with any kind of regulation, we have things functioning at the federal level and at the state level. So interstate movement really is a partnership between the U.S. Department of Agriculture at the federal level through APHIS, that's the Animal Plant Health Inspection Service, and then each individual state's Department of Agriculture and or their state animal health official, what we often call their state vet. And states have the authority to establish import requirements for animals entering their state. But USDA will often provide kind of this national coordination, policy recommendations, kind of this technical expertise, and they will also offer direct support when there is a disease outbreak.
And I know it's frustrating as it sounds. That's why one state may have slightly different requirements than another.
And the most important thing to remember from state to state is that every state has unique disease risks. Different livestock industries. So if there's different zoonotic diseases between species, they'll make decisions based on what other livestock industries are in their state, different wildlife populations, different animal movement patterns. So state animal health officials are kind of constantly evaluating all those risks as it relates to their home state.
Okay, so now let's circle back to the whole movement restrictions, because we've talked about them a lot over the past year or so. But as we think about New World Screwworm is the one that comes to the top of my mind, or others, those are great examples of why we have a variety of different kind of patchwork, if you will, restrictions in place.
Yeah, exactly. So the three most recognizable, most recent examples we have are EHV1, equine herpes virus 1. We've had multiple outbreaks of that. New World Screwworm, actively happening. And vesticular stomatitis. And so those three diseases have three very different transmissions. EHV1, respiratory, touching, germs, that kind of stuff. New World Screwworm, it's a fly. It's flying around. VS is spread through biting gnats. And so a gnat will bite one infected horse and then go bite another horse and infect it. And so these different diseases and infestations can spread through animal movement. And even though they're all different types of transmissions, and also these diseases all have different location risks. So like New World Screwworm, that's really a Southwestern issue right now. And so that's where the heaviest movement restrictions are. Vesicular stomatitis, that's also kind of a Southwestern issue up into California and Colorado. And so those specific areas are having movement restrictions based on VS outbreaks. And then EHV1, that tends to be a more localized movement restriction specific to an event. So they will do contact tracing with something like EHV1 to identify where that outbreak occurrence is. And then movement restrictions will be based on who's been to that area.
So not to drill down too much, but let's pick on New World Screwworm for a minute, because in Texas, they have a variety of different approaches depending on whether you're in an infected zone or not in an infected zone. So talk about that a minute.
So in Texas, the Texas Animal Health Commission, or TAC, has established what they call these New World Screwworm infested zones. And this is a really good example of that top-down federal guidance recommendation intersecting with kind of these state level needs, right? So USDA has put out policy guidelines for what to do if you have screwworm in your state, and they recommend 20 kilometer infested zones around an animal that has been determined to be infested with New World screwworm. So horses and other warm-blooded animals located within these infested zones can't simply be hauled to another part of Texas or another state without meeting specific movement requirements and receiving authorization from a livestock inspector. So the restriction isn't because they're kind of crossing any sort of physical boundary, like state line or anything like that. It's because officials are trying to keep the screwworm from spreading beyond that 20 kilometer infested zone.
We could talk a little bit more about EHV1 or some of the others, but I think the bottom line that everybody needs to know is that movement restrictions are based on disease risk, not on convenience, if you will. So how do officials decide when a movement restriction is necessary?
That's the hard part, right? Because sometimes movement restrictions feel really inconvenient, especially if you have like a horse show you're trying to get to. But the goal, anytime these movement restrictions are set in place, it's a two-pronged goal. One, to contain the problem as quickly as possible to keep it from getting worse. And two, to maintain normal movement as much as possible and continuity of business as much as possible. And sometimes those two things are really hard to keep moving in a parallel direction. Sometimes you have to stop an event or stop interstate movement to contain the problem and stop it from reaching the national herd, because that's what we don't want, right? We don't want all 7 million horses to suddenly be having an EHV1 outbreak.
Yeah. I know that they're relying on veterinarians and diagnostic laboratories and disease investigations to understand what's going on, but horse owners also play an important role in this. So talk a minute about that, because that's one of the takeaways that I think horse owners really need to understand, is they have an important responsibility.
Yeah. So every horse owner wants to get to that show, right? The trail ride. They've been planning on it for months. But if your horse has been exposed to a disease, or you're located in an area that's under a movement restriction, following those rules isn't just about protecting your own horse. And a lot of times events may refund your money if you're under a movement restriction, because they want to protect all the horses at the event too, right? It's really important to protect the integrity of our events by making sure we're maintaining these high health standards. And us as horse owners, it can really stink to have to swallow that $200, $300, $500 entry fee or what have you. But being the Typhoid Mary that increases the spread of the EH1 outbreak is not a good look. And it's not a way to make friends.
Yeah, I know it can be disappointing to miss an event, but I think it's really important that people know they don't want to be ground zero. They don't want to be the one that set off one of these outbreaks.
Right, exactly. And I think one thing, too, when we talk about outbreaks, we talk about, you know, it's easy to think about national or going state to state, but some of these diseases are very localized. So things like strangles or EIA or rabies, and I say rabies, people think they don't have to worry about rabies, but we've had multiple horses reported the rabies this year already. A state animal health official may place your individual farm under a quarantine if you've had a positive for one of those diseases, for a reportable disease, and not place any other farms in the state under quarantine, or not put like a general area movement restriction. Just that one barn will have a movement restriction. And so it's a very targeted restriction, but it's incredibly important because it prevents one isolated case from becoming dozens, and especially something like rabies or strangles. Those can have very, very severe consequences.
Okay, so let's jump ahead and tell horse owners where they should go if they're planning a trip.
First, talk to your veterinarian. Second, check with the event organizer, because many events have health requirements that go beyond state minimums. So they might have vaccine requirements or things like that. Most importantly, visit the website of your destination state. They're the authoritative source for current import requirements and disease outbreaks and quarantines, emergency orders, movement restrictions, that kind of stuff. Some place like the Equine Disease Communication Center is a really great website to check out to see where outbreaks are. However, EDCC won't have your state-specific movement requirements. You always need to check your local movement requirements as well as your destination movement requirements, especially if you're traveling during an active disease event, which we have going on right now with vesicular stomatitis and New World screwworm. And again, EHV keeps popping up over and over.
So I'm going to reiterate, please don't rely on what someone posted on a Facebook or social media site. Please go to the appropriate authorities to get information that you need.
Yes, yes, yes. That's yes, 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 yes. Well-intentioned advice, what people hear on Facebook, is not always accurate. And if it is accurate, it's not always current. So the official sources, especially when we're seeing things like New World screwworm, some of these movement restrictions are changing hourly as states try to figure out their plans or are getting infested zones, that kind of stuff. So the official sources are always the people managing the disease response. They're always going to be your number one go-to.
Okay, so the takeaway we'd like you to get today is that movement regulations aren't designed to keep horse owners from traveling. They are designed to keep horses healthy so we can continue to travel and we can compete and we can breed and we can enjoy our horses for years to come.
Exactly right. And again, we understand why these regulations exist, and it's really, really important that each of us does our part by following them. We're not helping to just protect our own horses, but we're protecting the entire industry.
Okay, so we're going to keep you updated on movement requirements as they evolve. And in the meantime, before you hitch up the trailer, check with your veterinarian, look at your destination event and your state Department of Agriculture or your state animal health official. A few minutes of planning can protect your horse and help protect horses across the country. So thank you for joining us today. We'll provide more numbers and links in our show notes. We invite you to support our beloved industry and join the American Horse Council. You can earn a free subscription to our monthly newsletter, which shares the latest in all of our legislative happenings, federal and state, as well as much more information that horse owners like you need to know.
And follow the American Horse Council on social media. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, X, formerly Twitter, and LinkedIn. And you can also subscribe to this podcast RSS feed. You can subscribe to Horses in the Morning on any podcast player and find all the shows, including ours, on the Horse Radio Network at horseradionetwork.com.
And as always, we like to say we are #HereForHorses. Thanks for listening.